Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. There's been a lot of talk about the geopolitics of the Paris attacks, as there should be. Best not to forget the economics, though. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risdahl. It is the 17th day of November, Tuesday. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. The aftermath of the events in Paris of last Friday are going to play out over time, as we all know. The investigations, the politics, the retaliation, all of it is going to unfold over the coming months and years. The economic future of the European Union, though, could get its first reality check on Friday. There's an emergency EU summit at the end of the week, and topic A is going to be the EU's open borders, what's known as the Schengen Agreement, which, at least for now, allows for the free movement of goods and, more importantly in this case, people once they are inside the EU. Some countries, France included, have already increased screening at their borders, and there are calls to toss out the Schengen Agreement altogether. So Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us started today with what tightened borders might mean for business.
European businesses have gotten used to the open border policy. Bart Lemaire's potato exporting business in Belgium depends on it.
We are buying potatoes on the farms here in Europe. We are processing them and we are exporting our processed and fresh potatoes through Europe and through the world.
But his drivers have already noticed changes at borders.
We do see that there is more police on the roads. We do see that there is more attention given.
So far, Lemaire says the tightened borders haven't affected his business too much, but other parts of Europe are seeing bottlenecks. Robert Handfield at North Carolina State University knows way more than most of us about the global supply chain.
They're struggling with getting food shipments on time. They're struggling with, you know, trucks that are bottled up at border crossings, trains that are being held up for inspection.
Companies whose job it is to move goods around are taking notice and preparing. Troy Cooper of XPO Logistics.
We expect in the future that there will be different border controls that will experience delays, but we'll adapt our optimization of our schedules and make sure that we are notifying customers.
With all the calls to dump the open border policy, multinational firms in particular could be vulnerable. Yossi Sheffi, a transportation logistics expert at MIT, says they may have to bring back some old strategies.
It used to be that they had a distribution center in every European country. It was a very inefficient system. The system now is much more efficient as long as the borders are open and allow for free flow of goods.
And right now, many Europeans want the free flow of goods and people stopped. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There are a lot of moving parts with these Paris attacks and the aftermath thereof. We took on part of it yesterday, the how question about how ISIS pays for itself and its operations. Today, we're going to take another slice, how ISIS and terrorist groups writ large coordinate what they do. For months now, government officials have been arguing with technology companies over encryption. Arguing with companies like Apple and Google and WhatsApp, they've started to encrypt messages and emails as a privacy measure those companies have and as a selling point, to be honest. The government wants access. We called our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, to help break it down. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
What, I guess maybe we should start with, what are some of the tools we're talking about here that these guys might have, might not have, we don't really know, used?
Yeah, encryption tools used to be a lot harder. It used to be the kind of thing where you had to have a long PGP key and you had to be pretty techie to figure it out.
I'm sorry, a long what?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
It wasn't fun. Now it's a lot easier. In fact, it's so easy that it's built into iMessage, for example. It's built into other consumer tools like WhatsApp. There are apps called Telegram and Wicker and kind of a lot of different options that you can download. And they have various levels of actual security. But for the most part, they mean that your messages, when they're sent from device to device, are encrypted in transit, so they can't be intercepted and read while you're sending them.
I understand why people would want to encrypt things, right? Bank account numbers, passwords, stuff you don't want people to read. The question is, does this encryption really work? Like, no fooling.
Well, no encryption is foolproof. And that's absolutely the case. In fact, encryption, a lot of security experts will tell you that encryption is only as good, any security is only as good as the person on the other end of the message.
Before I move on, I just want to be clear. We're talking about apps that you can download from the app, whatever app store you use, right? I mean, they're just out there.
They are just out there, okay. Yeah. And part of why this has become such a big conversation is that companies like Apple and Google are starting to build in encryption. For a long time, you had to go seek it out. You had to find it. You had to implement it. Now it's built into the apps that you're using every day.
All right. So Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, on the Intelligence Committee in the Senate, she is now saying that Silicon Valley companies, by providing this encryption, as we were just talking about, are actually helping terrorists, and that this stuff can't be decrypted even if they get a court order. Where does this go? What does the government want, do you suppose?
They want a backdoor. Yeah. And they've wanted a backdoor for a while. In fact, that conversation, I believe you and I even talked about it on this very program. It was an ongoing argument. It was a longstanding request. And the FBI had sort of backed away from that. They had said, you know, clearly people don't want a backdoor, because creating a backdoor into encrypted products doesn't just create a backdoor for the government. It creates a backdoor for any hacker who also wants to break in. And I think, you know, it's been a long time coming, but American consumers have also said that they want privacy and security. They're overwhelmingly worried about identity theft, and they're worried about their communications being intercepted and hacked, because that causes them real harm in the world too. And so it's a really tricky argument. I think it's only going to get more intense. But I think companies, Silicon Valley companies and other companies, banks even, have started to realize that privacy and security for their consumers is a real selling point.
Is there a way, do you suppose, that the government ever gets ahead of terrorists and encryption and technology, or are they always, almost by definition, playing catch up?
I'm not sure that catch up is necessarily the right way to put it. I think that you could say technology is and always has been an arms race. And you know, that was the case in World War II.
Yeah.
And so there will always be a race to stay ahead of any bad guy, no matter what technology or tools they're using. That's sort of just the nature of the chase.
Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, with the long view right there. Thank you, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
Speaking of the long view, that is not Wall Street. Traders were pretty subdued today, a breather, you might say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is news of inflation today. There is none still in this economy. The Consumer Price Index came out this morning. The basket of goods the Labor Department tracks to come up with the index bumped up just 0.2% last month. Of course, rent is included in that basket. And if you are a renter in one of the big cities where lots of people want to live and work, sadly, you're pretty much out of luck. Rents are up 13% in San Francisco, 11.5% in Denver, and they are shooting up in some less obvious hotspots as well. Cincinnati, Kansas City, Atlanta. Vacancy rates are low. There hasn't been a whole lot of new home building since the recession, so rents are likely to keep rising for a while. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is based in Portland, Oregon, where rents are up, oh, by the by, 10.5% over the past year. Here's Mitchell.
About a week ago, I jumped in my car and headed to a demo against home demolition. The honking from supportive passersby indicates just how much building demolition is a flashpoint here. Developers are tearing down older, low-rent apartments and putting up flashy new ones, often at double or triple the rent. The decrepit apartment building here is on valuable land in the middle of a busy commercial strip. The protesters are at least spirited.
We got chips and hummus, bro, and a cold one if you want one.
Here's another of the affordable housing organizers, retiree Michael Johnson.
There's a lot of people that can't afford to live in those steel and glass condos they're putting up everywhere. I think the mayor has given the developers pretty much a free rein of the city.
I try to talk to the developer. He's with the demolition crew behind a line of cops.
Get out of the street, sir. It's a very simple thing to do.
I want to ask him if he can talk.
You can go over there. Am I making myself clear?
There's now a protester who's gotten up on the roof, and it's getting kind of tense. So I walk a few doors down to a shop that sells tie-dyes and Tibetan knickknacks. Owner Nettie Hayes says she's worried, too, about rising rents, up more than 10% this year.
But everybody has a right to do what they want with their property, and it's unfortunate when some buildings go, there's not really anything that you can do about it. You have to be able to accommodate how we're growing.
How America's urban areas are growing is from young college grads flooding in for jobs in tech and other hot fields, empty nesters moving back downtown with lots of disposable income. Nicholas Ritsinas at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies says that's who developers are building for.
Last year, median rent of a newly constructed rental housing was about $1,300 a month. That would equal about 50% of the median income of renters nationwide, which means that over half of all renters really couldn't afford that rent.
Throw a stone in Portland and you'll find someone who's been displaced by rising rents.
Yeah, you want to turn on 28th at this point?
Richard Seymour and I are doing a drive-by of the fourplex where he lived for 15 years.
This house is a sort of Victorian 1920.
It's got construction trucks outside now. The owner sold to a young couple from out of town a couple months ago.
For $800,000. And what happened the next day, everybody in the apartment got either an eviction notice or a substantial rent hike. So my $700 rent was suddenly $2,000.
City government is trying to address the rent crisis.
Like the Dickens quote, it is the best of times and the worst of times.
That's Portland Mayor Charlie Hales. He says neighborhoods are booming, there are lots of new well-paying jobs, but
someone who's working for moderate wages trying to hang on to your rental unit, it's a scary time.
Mayor Hales has declared a housing emergency, like in L.A., Seattle, and Hawaii. The city's pumping more than $150 million into affordable housing, but that'll only meet a fraction of the need. And like other big city mayors, his hands are tied.
The legislature has preempted us from having rent control. We need to have the private market required to do more, and that's private developers, to set aside a percentage of those units to be affordable.
But Portland developer Eric Kress says that would lead businessmen like him to build fewer new apartments when more are needed. Affordable housing mandates, he says, cut into profitability.
I would say the challenge is we're in a competitive marketplace. So let's say, for instance, I decided to put 2 affordable units for every 20 units I build. I wouldn't be able to provide the yields to attract the money to build the building.
And Richard Seymour, remember his rent went up 300% overnight? He works for a nonprofit and couldn't find anything he could afford near his job and family. So now he's raiding his retirement and looking for the cheapest fixer he can find.
I am now buying a house, or hope I'm buying a house, and some of the houses I've looked at have tenants in them, and so I might have to evict somebody in order for me to have a roof over my head. And that, you know, just makes me very sad.
It's a dog-eat-dog rental world out there. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Oh, there's black shoes, there's purple shoes. Some shoes are exactly the same, but have slightly different colors.
A look into somebody else's closet, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 6 points today. That is 0.04%. Ended at 17,489, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ nudged up a single point, closed at 4986. We're not even bothering with percentages there. The S&P 500 slipped 2 points, about a 10%, 2050. Big news in the industrial gas industry. Air Liquide, the French supplier, was said to be bidding for Airgas. That is a U.S. supplier of gases for welding and other uses. Air Liquide would become the world's biggest in that business, up 2.5%. Airgas up 29%. Their competitor, Praxair, it's called, down 0.2% today. The Justice Department unsealed an indictment against supplement maker USP Labs. Stores that sell gym rat products felt faint. Shares of GNC Holdings weakened 6.1%. Vitamin Shop shares swallowed 5%, practically. Bond prices held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Millennial Voices on Advancing the American Dream is the subject of a hearing of Congress's Joint Economic Committee. Also in Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for October. And we go to Asheville, North Carolina for other housing news. The National Gingerbread House Competition opens for tours. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As parents of the millions of high school seniors out there well know, we are smack dab in the middle of college application season. But as you help or harass, depending on your household, your kid into filling out all the paperwork and writing all the essays, here is a somewhat sobering item for you from a group called the National Student Clearinghouse. Despite a huge push to get more people in this country into and ultimately through college, the percentage of students actually finishing their degrees continues to decline. Of the nearly 3 million people who started college in 2009, just over half, 53%, had finished 6 years later. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
In many ways, this is a story about the recession and its aftermath. In 2009, a lot more people went to college, many to take shelter from the bad economy or learn new skills. And far more of those students were adults and part-timers who tend to have lower graduation rates. Then the job market slowly improved.
Many of these students may have chosen to leave college, whether they had a degree or not, if there was a better job waiting for them in the improving economy.
That's Doug Shapiro with the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center. He says others left because rising tuition made college unaffordable, and cuts to state funding made it tougher for schools to provide the classes and support services students needed to graduate.
So there was a real squeeze on the institutions that made it harder for them to meet the needs of this big influx of students.
Still, many see the latest report as another sign that colleges, and high schools for that matter, are not doing enough to help students make it to graduation. Amy Leitnin is director for higher education at the New America Foundation. She says the report paints colleges with a pretty broad brush, and some schools are doing a better job.
But we have to get much more detailed to figure out which schools are serving students better.
And a lot of the efforts to improve completion rates really got underway just a few years ago. Vincent Tento is professor emeritus at Syracuse University.
So I would urge our listeners to just be patient. And I think you'll see this is a blip, which is not surprising given the effects of a recession.
Tinto says even though completion rates fell by 2 percentage points, 71,000 more people who started college in 2009 got degrees than those who started the year before. And those degrees should pay off. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Desperate times, the saying goes, call for desperate measures. That does go some way toward explaining the latest marketing move by Hallmark, perhaps. The company is doing something out of the ordinary in its holiday ad campaign for its keepsake Christmas tree ornaments. Straight up online videos as opposed to old-fashioned TV spots. Crazy, right? Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now from New York on why a very old brand is taking a big step away from traditional media.
The typical Hallmark ad is nobody's idea of cutting edge. They range from weepy sentimentality to sweetness on the level of doing shots of corn syrup. The new digital campaign is a bit edgy by Hallmark standards. It pokes fun at modern holiday scenes, like the sad grandpa stuck at a pretentious family dinner.
And this here? I mean,
it's a tofu brick with scallion wash.
I'll tell you what, I'll just have the ham. Pass the ham, please.
Dad, we're not having ham this year.
The hope is that putting videos on the web rather than on TV will make it easier to reach specific people and track whether they buy.
There's so much more time, but also an uptick in the quality of time that our target audience, which is the millennial mom, is spending with digital media.
Catherine Cartwright is with Criterion Global, which did the media planning for Hallmark's Keepsake Ornaments campaign.
She's watching Scandal in bed after the kids fall asleep. She's playing Words with Friends. It's these kind of intimate moments that we see as really ripe opportunities in terms of media engagement.
Those moments on smartphones and tablets are eclipsing moments that might have included watching TV. Americus Reed is a Wharton School marketing professor.
The fact that she's doing all of these things as a millennial mom, all of these activities, means that she's not going to be sitting around looking at television ads.
It's not that TV ads are dying. The market is still tens of billions of dollars bigger than digital video. And Dan Rayburn, digital media analyst with Frost & Sullivan, is skeptical of lofty claims about laser-focused targeting.
Everyone says they can do targeting,
But any consumer who's gone online and seen the same ad 5, 6, 7, 10 times in a row sometimes will tell you that's obviously not targeting.
Even in the digital era, finding that elusive customer remains a moving target. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
If I say to you, think of a place with a deep culture connected to the fashion industry, and oh, by the way, this place has to accommodate brands worth tens of billions of dollars, you might come up with Paris, for one, or London, Milan, maybe. What about Portland, Oregon? Not only are the rents high, but John Sepulvedo of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports Portland is a hub of the sneaker industry, which means it's also home to some serious sneaker culture.
Poor Rosalind James. She doesn't have any closet space for her shoes. That's because her boyfriend takes all the closet space for his shoes.
Oh, there's black shoes, there's purple shoes. Some shoes are exactly the same but have slightly different colors. One time I came home and there were 6 boxes of shoes in the living room of Adidas, just stacked, like not even touched, not even like excited that they were home. There's just shoes forever.
And here's the thing, when James's boyfriend moved to Portland, he didn't have 30 pairs of sneakers as he does now. He had 4 pairs of shoes, one for running, a dressy pair, a pair for basketball, and one for everything else. I know, because I'm her boyfriend. And I can tell you that Portland has changed me. I've become shoe obsessed, in large part because so many other people here are too. Take Bobby Jackson. I met him shopping for shoes downtown.
Well, when I was younger, I think this is what it was. My dad gave me one pair of shoes, all black, and like, son, it goes with everything, so you're wearing these. So I just, you know, I was pretty upset, and so I think that challenged what I'm in, you know, today.
But if shoe collecting is a sport, Jackson's at the Super Bowl, and I'm playing Tecmo Bowl on a black and white TV. That's because Jackson has about 100 pairs of sneakers.
You know, this is something we really like. You know, other people have art. You know, this is a different form of art. So, you know, it just depends on whatever you like and, you know, buy what you like.
That kind of demand has led to shops like the one I met Jackson in. It's a sneaker consignment shop in downtown Portland called Index, where you can find used sneakers for thousands of dollars. Owner Terrence Ricketts says besides reselling other people's sneakers, his store also spends a lot of time facilitating third-party deals.
You know, people meet in our store and do third-party sales all the time. We don't mind because it's a safer place to get it done. I mean, you're not going to get robbed in some, you know, parking lot if you're buying, you know, sneakers from, you know, some random person.
Now, if you're saying to yourself, okay, there are a lot of sneakerheads everywhere. After all, the industry generates more than $20 billion in revenue in the U.S., not to mention the resale sneaker market, which generates about $1 billion each year. Well, to that, I would say, oh, yeah, but does your city have a sneaker cart? You know, like a food cart, but for sneakers? Because Portland has one. Oh, and does your hometown have big corporate offices for shoe markets like Nike, Adidas, Under Armour, Keen, and Columbia? Because Portland does. And sneaker enthusiasts have literally picked up and moved to Portland with no experience and almost nothing to their name just for a shot to work in the sneaker business.
Both of us moved out here, sold everything. Moved out here with 2 suitcases.
Jimmy Taylor moved to Portland from Australia with his wife so he could be closer to the sneaker industry.
Since I was a little kid, I played sport growing up all the time. Always played sport, always loved art. So I was always, I think I've still got a whole sketchbook at home of shoes I designed when I was like 9 years old.
Well, hopefully that sketchbook isn't at the bottom of a closet because chances are he'll never find it. As for me, my girlfriend Rosalind James has given me an ultimatum. Get rid of the ugly shoes or else. I'm not sure what the or else is, but I can promise you this. I'm going to keep the shoes. In Portland, Oregon, I'm John Sepulvedo for Marketplace.
The This final note on the way out today, a reminder that sometimes business is still done the old-fashioned way. You remember how Donald Trump hosted Saturday Night Live last week and how there was all kinds of speculation that his rivals for the GOP nomination would ask for equal time as law and regulation allows? Three of them have. Lindsey Graham, George Pataki, and John Kasich each sent letters, actual letters, to NBC and its affiliates asking for airtime. Trump was on screen for 12 minutes and 5 seconds, should you be interested in keeping track of this one. Also corresponding the old-fashioned way, Janet Yellen, the chair of the Federal Reserve. Dr. Yellen sent a letter today to Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, also Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, telling Congress, in essence, to keep its hands off monetary policy. There is a bill up for debate in the House, could be voted on this week, that would force the Fed to tie interest rates to a mathematical formula based on unemployment and inflation. Yellen calls that a grave mistake, which is, I believe, not coming as a huge surprise. Also, did anybody catch John Sepulveda there basically calling out his girlfriend on the radio? I don't know what the or else is, but I'm keeping the sneakers. She's going to hear that piece. You know that, John, right? All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 6 points today, 0.04%. The NASDAQ nudged up a single point, basically flat. The S&P 500 down 0.2%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer is Nishat Kirwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.